Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 19, recorded August 10th, 2011. Dr. Miguel Nicolelis. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your new account for 6 months, go to Squarespace.com and use the offer code Triangulation8. And by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, and iPhone or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to Netflix.com/TWiT. Hey, welcome to Triangulation. I'm Tom Merritt, filling in for... Well, I'm not filling in. I'm moving over into the host slot. Leo Laporte out on jury duty. So, in effect, filling in for me is Dr. Kiki, Kirsten Sanford. Hi, Kiki.
Hi, Tom. It's good to be here.
And one of the reasons we wanted to have Kiki on this episode is we are going to get to talk to Dr. Miguel Nicolelis. Now, he does amazing work with brain-computer interfaces. He's done experiments that have monkeys controlling computers with their mind. It sounds like science fiction.
It sounds like science fiction, but it's not. It's really happening, and it could be the way that we interact with computers in the future. It's all in our minds, man.
Yeah. It's really fascinating stuff. We're going to get to talk to Miguel about not only the brain-computer interface, but artificial intelligence and his opinions on that, and what down the road, hundreds of years from now, what kinds of advances we may have. So we'll get him on the line here in just a second. But first, want to thank our sponsor. On Triangulation, we couldn't do it without them, Squarespace.com. We talk about them all the time. Fast and easy way to make a website. So if you are out there with a special project that you want to get kickstarted and you need a home for it, if you've got your philosophical thoughts that you want to put online, try out Squarespace.com. It's customizable. It's simple. It's easy. If you've got any idea in your head right now for a website, go to Squarespace.com and sign up. You'll be amazed how fast and easy you'll get a great-looking website going. And if it gets really popular, you don't have to worry about, oh, geez, I got to add capacity, I got to do this. They take care of all of that for you, and they allow you to take your data with you. Don't feel like you're going to get locked in, like, what if I don't like Squarespace down the road? You're going to love it. But if you didn't, for some weird reason, they let you take your data with you, so you're not locked in. There's really no risk. You don't need a credit card or anything. You just go try it out at Squarespace.com. Use the offer code TRIANGULATION8 when you sign up. And after the trial period, if you decide to purchase it, you'll get 10% off for 6 months. That code is TRIANGULATION8. Go give Squarespace a shot, and we thank them for their support of Triangulation. All right, so let's talk to Dr. Miguel Nicolelis. He is professor of neuroscience at Duke University. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you very much for the invitation. It's a pleasure.
It's great to have you along. We're very excited. I believe it may have been a Scientific American article I read. I'm not sure exactly, but I was reading about the brain computer interface work that you've been doing, and I got really excited. And I know Dr. Kiki here is also really into this topic as well. Yeah. Just to start us off, give us sort of an overview of what this field is.
Well, this is a pretty young field. You know, it's only about 10 years that we acquired the ability to record the electrical signals of large populations of brain cells simultaneously, you know, above 100 cells. And by recording these signals, we also learn how to read the messages embedded in these electrical storms that the brain produces and decode motor information that is embedded in them, and try to translate these codes and these commands into digital language so that a brain could directly control the movements of an artificial device, a robotic arm, a robotic leg, or even a virtual body. And after a decade, we are actually establishing a direct communication, bidirectional direct communication between the brain and these devices. So we can now read these messages from brain activity primarily in animals and send them to these devices. And then as these devices perform the movement that the brain has imagined, we can get information from these devices back directly to the brain. So the brain can understand what these objects are, what these actuators are touching.
So this is more, I mean, I think people have seen the ball that you can levitate with your mind. And that's not at all the same thing of what you're talking about.
Well, that's, one of the first game applications.
Or, yeah.
You know, just a toy. What we are talking about is literally reading motor thoughts or motor information produced by the brain ahead of the generation of any movement and using this information to produce movements in an artificial device that can be used, we hope, in the future to restore mobility to, for instance, patients that cannot move their bodies anymore.
Yeah, so the thing that, I think Dr. Keek and I were talking about this a little beforehand, that is amazing is you're able to directly read what is going on, the electrical signals from the brain. Is that right? You're doing more than just saying, oh, there's activity concentrated here and we don't know what it means. You're reading it at a little higher level.
Oh, no, yes. We have moved past that point. About 15 years ago, we and others discovered that you could record the signals from hundreds of brain cells and actually extract some information out of them and actually use this information to generate motion. And now we are learning that we can send signals back to the brain, signals that are generated as these robotic arms, for instance, or virtual arms, touch an object and let the brain decode the tactile information that is acquired by these artificial devices and learn what these objects are. And, you know, so we're basically establishing a communication that goes beyond the borders, the physical constraints imposed by the body on the brain.
That's amazing. So in a sense, you're allowing proprioception with this feedback that you're communicating from an object to the brain.
Yeah, technically we call it tactile processing. So we are sending signals about texture or shape of the objects. But yes, proprioception is something that we have started to work and it follows the same principle.
So you could actually sort of feel something with a robotic arm?
Yeah, we're starting to have monkeys that can have that experience.
That's amazing.
So, yeah.
How do you tell what the monkeys are feeling?
Yeah, that's a tricky question because you cannot ask. There are all sorts of indirect ways to test that. And this has been done for decades now in neuroscience. So you have to behaviorally inquire the animal to demonstrate that what he's feeling, not only in these experiments, but in other experiments, is somewhat similar to a regular sensation that he had before. So there are some indirect ways to do that, but it can be done. It can, to a level, you can have a quantitative measurement of what these animals are experiencing.
You're talking earlier about the population, large populations of neurons, about 100 neurons that you're recording from. You're using electrode systems to record the electrical activity directly from the motor cortex areas of the brain, right? What kind of electrodes how do you get a resolution, or what is your resolution? Are you looking to get finer resolution as you move forward with your research?
Yes, we're now reaching a milestone of 1,000 neurons. We're very close to that milestone now, 1,000 neurons recorded simultaneously. And you're right, we use matrices or cubes of microwires, microfilaments that look like a hair, you know, that you can implant in the brain without creating too much trouble. You can implant hundreds of these microwires, and they basically are placed between brain cells in the extracellular space where they can record the electrical currents that flow from these cells around in this space. And we basically sort these signals And we look for these messages by combining the information of, you know, these large populations that come from many places in the brain, many places in the cortex, not only on the traditional motor areas that we all talk about, but also tactile areas or areas in other regions of the cortex that were not supposed to be involved in this kind of behaviors. But we are showing that actually, because most of the cortex is multitasking and is processing information from different sensory channels and different types of parameters are coded simultaneously by each of these cells, we can get information from a lot of the cortex simultaneously.
So is there a specific aspect of your algorithm that can tell the difference between, say, the monkey thinking about moving its arm or the robot leg? Is there a limb?
When you look at the brain activity of these animals, there is some sort of a spatiotemporal signature, a dynamics that looks like that can identify whether the animal is moving its own body or is moving a robotic device or is sensing something with its own hand or with an artificial device. So that's another level of analysis where you can see that our experiments support the notion or the theory that artificial devices are incorporated by the brain as an extension of the sense of self, as an extension of this internal model that we all have that defines our body boundaries or our sense of being and occupying a physical body. For us, our data seems to indicate that any tool that we operate is assimilated by the brain. You know, our computers, our computer mice, our cars, our bikes, our rackets,
pencil,
clothing, glasses, everything that we basically control and is used as a tool to extend our reach into the world becomes an extension of us, literally, for the brain. And we have documented that by showing brain activity that is related to artificial tools embedded in the brain.
One of the most promising uses of this that I hear discussed is obviously artificial limbs for people, the replacements that allow them to feel, replace the functionality that they may have lost. But it's not limited to that. I mean, you're doing this in experiments at a distance. What are some of the other applications that you're immediately seeing that this could be put to use for?
Of course, the first level of translation of this research is going to happen in rehabilitation medicine. You know, in the near future, you're going to see a lot of different therapies based on this, what we call neuroprosthetic devices, as you said, devices that will aim at restoring motor sensory functions lost to disease or trauma of the nervous system. But you're absolutely right. The reach of this technology in the long run can go way beyond that. Because, as you mentioned, we demonstrated that we could use, for instance, an animal here in the East Coast of the United States and send the brain activity of this animal all the way to Kyoto, Japan, and get a humanoid robot to walk in Kyoto autonomously under the control of this brain activity. So literally that robot was walking in Japan with under the control of a mind that was on the East Coast of the United States. And for that matter, that robot could be on the surface of Mars, you know, you could get the same effect in theory.
You'd have a lag in communications, but otherwise...
Yeah, you had a lag of communication. Yeah. Yes, the main problem there would be, the time that it takes for
distance.
The signals to get, to Mars.
That's
and come
why you
back.
Have to coordinate with the quantum physicists.
Yes.
Interdisciplinary.
Yes. But we have a big argument with the quantum physicists and the physicists in general. I mean, the physicists like to say that in the beginning there were physics, right?
Yes.
Always starts with physics. And we are now saying that in the beginning there was a brain, because if there was not a primate brain, there would never be physics. So that's our main argument now.
Uh-huh.
But that's a different story. Yeah.
That replaces chicken and egg, right?
Yes, it's
exactly.
Like that. Yeah, but I actually believe that in a few decades, you're going to have computer interfaces and the interactions that we have now with our machines that we create are going to be driven by brain activity alone. So you're actually going to be part of your computer desktop, and you're going to interact with the operating system just by thinking, and you're going to basically select whatever icons or be part of this virtual environment and do all your work using your brain activity rather than the physical movements of your body. Now, so this is going to come.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think this is going to come. In fact, many major computer companies are already thinking about the potential applications in the future of these brain-machine interfaces for computing. This is one level. You're going to have other levels in other industries that also are going to change dramatically the way we interact with, you know, regular tools. But this is going to take a little longer because, as you both mentioned, we need now to get the best signals. We need to implant devices into the brain.
Right.
The signals that you can get from the surface of the scalp, the electroencephalography or magnetoencephalography, they don't have the same kind of resolution that we need to do these tricks with, you know, that we can do in animals. But there are many groups trying to work on new techniques and new technologies to get better resolution on these non-invasive methods. So in the future, it's very likely that you are going to have a non-invasive technique that will allow all that we are learning now with implants to be done without the need of penetrating the brain tissue.
I think that seems that's probably one of the most pertinent issues for adoption is making it something that is like a Bluetooth headset or something that's very simple to apply. You don't have to go in for surgery to implant anything into your brain. Invasive stuff, it just is going to be a huge turnoff to all but the most most interested.
Well, it's all about cost and benefit, right? It's all about cost and benefit. We have millions of people today that walk in the streets and you don't even notice with a heart pacemaker, right?
Right.
When I was in medical school in 79, I saw one of the first heart pacemakers, and it was gigantic, and it required open heart surgery to be implanted. And the cardiologist that was my professor at that time, when we had to implant one of the first ones back in Brazil in medical school, he went to the guy and said, "Well, that's what we need to implant." The guy said, "Oh, no, never, ever." And the guy said, "Well, do you want to watch the soccer game on Sunday?" And the guy said, "Oh, absolutely." He said, "Well, we better implant this now." And it did get implanted, and the guy watched the soccer game. So there are millions of people now living with different sorts of body implants.
Right.
And it's all related to what is the purpose. And you're absolutely right that to justify a neurosurgery, no matter how simple it is, you have to be able to provide some really major therapy for people that don't have any other option. And that's where I see the invasive method providing, you know, some solutions for severely paralyzed patients who do not have, you know, any other alternative. But of course, the more you advance in the field, the more you learn about the potential of this field, and the better the non-invasive methods that you get. I think the broader the applications.
Yeah, because if I can learn to walk again or regain the ability to walk again, I'll allow an invasive neurosurgery, no problem.
Oh, I would.
You've got a little arthritis, we'll allow you to type on your computer without using your hands. I don't know if that's worth it to drill into my brain or not.
Yeah, that's the cost-benefit equation.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you were talking about someone that cannot move below the neck, if you can show that the technique is safe and that there are benefits, the improvement in the quality of life, improvement in communication, and the people feel better, you know, by being able to walk again and to interact socially better than they can right now. Of course, the procedure itself, we talk about brain surgery as if it's rocket science. It's not. You know, there are some things in neurosurgery that can be done that you'd be so surprised how simple they are.
You heard it, folks. Brain surgery. It's not rocket science.
It's not rocket science yet. And not quantum mechanics yet. But But we keep this in check all the time. You know, I'll give an example. We also work on a prosthetic device for Parkinson's disease that is going the opposite direction. What we are developing is a less invasive procedure in which you can get, in animals at least, the same effects of what today is a pre-invasive neurosurgery. This one is a tough one. You know, is a serious procedure with a 5% risk of something going bad. So we found out that you could use a superficial region of the brain down in the spinal cord to stimulate electrically and get rid of some of the main symptoms of Parkinson's disease in these animal models of this neurological disorder. And that would be a very simple procedure, you know, an outpatient procedure that could be used since the beginning of the diagnosis and for a long time if everything holds in primates and later in clinical trials. So we also work on non-invasive protocols or semi-invasive protocols that could alleviate, serious neurological problems.
In terms of some of the tools and the tech and the technology that's used for what you're doing, would you say that we're like back in like our bronze era, or are we, are we in modern day technology in terms of where we are and where we're going? Do you think that the technology has a lot of developments ahead for and room for improvement?
Oh no! Certainly, there is room for improvement, but I wouldn't call this bronze era. the wireless interface that we are about to test is pretty sophisticated. You know, it's like having tens of cell phones implanted on your head and broadcasting brain activity all over the place. And the exoskeleton, for instance, that my good friend Gordon Schenk is developing over in Munich in Germany, that will be used, I hope, in our project, in our Walk Again project, this project that we created aiming at restoring full body mobility to a quadriplegic patient in the next few years. That is a pretty sophisticated piece of hardware that uses the most modern robotics and control theory and engineering that you can find. But of course, there are other areas where we can certainly improve. We are just about to introduce supercomputing capabilities to the analysis of brain or neurophysiological data. This is a very new era where we can now, since we collect terabytes of data per minute, when we're recording, close to 1,000 cells, we are running out of computer power to really fully analyze this data and to visualize it. Because when you look at these signals, I like to call it a brain symphonies. They are really amazing, and we have just touched the tip of the iceberg in terms of analyzing these signals, particularly populational signals of this magnitude. Thousands of cells, and to make someone really take advantage of a full body prosthetic, we will have to get to 10 to 20,000 neurons recorded simultaneously, and nobody has touched that territory. Nobody really has touched the territory of 1,000 neurons at this point. So we are just about to engage on a program in which the neurophysiological data that we collect is going to be analyzed by a supercomputer. So it's a pretty open field. And that's state-of-the-art technology.
This may be pie-in-the-sky question. Do you think while we go to the trouble of interpreting all of this data that we'll be able to reverse engineer it? Will we be able to more easily create artificial intelligence somehow?
Yeah, I'm in a different position from most of people working in artificial intelligence for a series of reasons that, in fact, I discuss in my book and in an article in Scientific American recently. I don't believe that we will ever be able to reproduce a human brain on silicon or in a digital machine or in a Turing machine like the computers that we have today. Is for me and for others that believe in this vision, is a scientific impossibility, because we simply cannot reproduce the evolutionary history and the personal history, individual history that created the type of circuits and brain circuits that each one of us has. So the brain is somewhat protected by its own way of working, the way that it was put together and the way that it operates with this continuous adaptation, this continuous reshaping of itself with each experience or each behavior, it provides a bulletproof protection against cloning of its architecture and its abilities. So I'm on the opposite domain of the singularity field, the singularity believers that think that machines are going to overcome us pretty soon and become more intelligent or more sophisticated than we are. They may become intelligent and they may even become conscious to a certain degree, but I don't ever believe that a human brain will be copied in silicon or on by a digital computer. We simply cannot reduce humanity or human behavior to a computational algorithm. It's a non-computable thing.
But what if we got away from silicon? What if we I don't know if I'm thinking of bubble memory or quantum or even biological computing.
Yes.
Would we be able to grow something just as adaptable?
That's very interesting. You may be able to grow biological stuff that is adaptable for sure, but again, it's going to be very difficult to reduce or to reproduce a human brain based on an algorithmic approach. You may develop something different, and I'm not saying that you cannot get machine intelligence. You may get machine intelligence, but what I'm trying to say is that it's not going to be human intelligence.
Right.
We simply cannot reduce that to a computer algorithm. And many authors have debated this in the past and have supported this vision too. But recently, as you know, a lot of hype has been put into this idea that we are going to really surpass this little thing that we carry between our ears. I don't buy it.
it's good to think about the fact that we might not surpass it, but it will add to what we're able to do. So understanding how the brain works, being able to reverse engineer aspects of cognitive processes, that's going to add to what the brain itself is able to do and going to, like any tool, add to our reach.
Oh, absolutely. I totally agree with that. And I also think that the only way for machines to become human-like is to be assimilated by us. And that's what our brain does all the time. As I said, a racket becomes a tennis racket becomes a real tool with a purpose and meaning when it's being held by a human hand, controlled by a human brain. And the same thing with a soccer ball, and the same thing with a computer. So this symbiosis, what a lot of people fear and a lot of people have a lot of reservations about, I actually take it as a pretty natural. All technology that we see around us actually came from our brains. It's a creation of our brains. It's a projection of our brains of what we need to have to engage or increase our reach with the world that we that surrounds us. So I actually see machines as an extension of us, and it's only proper that the brain takes it in a straight way and basically simply assimilates them as part of us.
I'm wondering about the artificial intelligence processes that they're using right now, where they're trying to use human learning as a way to develop artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. Do you think that those particular directions of research, it's going to get human-like, but not get us to the human?
It's very interesting. All this work, in artificial intelligence from an intellectual point of view is very interesting. I actually got motivated in part to do what I do by reading about artificial intelligence back in the 80s, And at that point, there was a tremendous enthusiasm, At MIT, everybody was betting if it was next week or 2 weeks afterwards that the artificial intelligence lab would prove that they could beat the Turing test. And there would be, intelligent machines walking all over Boston, and taking over the professors at Harvard from MIT.
Playing for the Red Sox.
Yeah, exactly. And the Red Sox would win the World Series, 10 times in a row. It never happened. I witnessed that that period of time where, you know, several guys there were saying, oh, it's about to happen. It didn't happen. And it's not going to happen the way it was envisioned at that time, I think. And that's my position as a neuroscientist. But, of course, lots of interesting stuff is going to come out of it. And lots of interesting understanding about mechanisms of human learning and human cognition can be derived from these studies and these experiments. But I think the last river will never be crossed. We'll never be able to cross the last border and claim that a machine that we create is one of us and is human. I don't think that will ever happen.
So if I get this right, you're saying not just that we won't be able to create something to surpass us, but we won't even create something that is so good that it can fool us. Do you think we won't even pass the Turing test with machines?
Based on the what we have in terms of computers today, you know, based on the Turing machines that we have today. You mentioned, you know, just two potential very interesting lines of work that, you know, biological computers and quantum computers, that has to be seen, because certainly I don't know much about them, and very few people know what they are capable of doing, because in fact some of them do not exist yet.
Right.
They're theoretical experiments at this point. But based on what we know from Turing machines, no matter how, and I'll give an example. We saw a few months ago, right, Watson, that IBM computer playing Jeopardy, I guess. Jeopardy and chess and things like that are basically things that are well confined under very well defined rules, right? Mm-hmm. You have a very precise, very well defined set of rules that govern that particular game or that particular behavior. Computers can excel at that. And certainly they can do better than us. But when you come out of that environment, when you come out of that well-controlled, well-limited and well-defined environment, and you get to real life where we excel because we are really well adapted to basically take whatever is thrown at us and react to it, machines do not do very well. In fact, I was just in a meeting a couple months ago in Zurich with one of the founders of robotics, one of the greatest roboticists in the world, and he was very keen to say that no matter what lab you go in the world, you don't find a robot that can do some things that a 3-year-old, a 2-year-old kid can do very easily. Okay, and that's well known. It's not well spoken. You know, people don't want to talk about that because we all think about robotics as something that is at the cusp or the edge of throwing us into the ocean.
But yeah, killing us all.
But you just need to look at what happened in Japan recently. You know, during the tsunami and the earthquake and the tsunami afterwards, and the Japanese robots are phenomenal. You know, I go to meetings all over the world, and most of the time I see robots playing violin, ping pong, and doing everything, but right. Robots did not get into the nuclear power plant and did the work that we supposedly or they supposedly could do, right? Where those robots? Where those very smart machines that could, you know, clean all the mess up there that we created on that place? They were not there because they don't exist. So, unfortunately, humans had to go there and try to fix the problem. And this is not only true for that issue or that question, but it's true for a lot and the vast majority of the problems, because they are not as circumscribed and well-limited as Jeopardy or chess is.
We definitely see robots designed for certain purposes. There's no all-around robot. I mean, a human can be trained for particular tasks, but they're also going to be good at a variety of others. And as you've said, adaptable and can throughout their lives learn to do new things. A robot that's designed for a particular purpose is not going to be able to do that unless you take it apart and build it.
Right. Yeah. And we know the robots did very well in assembly lines, right? Building automobiles or, you know, whatever mechanical, well-defined task, they do very well. And that's wonderful because you don't want to have humans doing that for a life anymore. But when it comes to write poetry, compose music, or play soccer, it's difficult. You're not going to get a robot to replace a Brazilian forward, you know?
I wish they had done the Jeopardy experiment with, instead of having Watson represented by a computer, have no people and not tell us which of the three was Watson and which were the two human competitors, and see if, I think it still would have been obvious which one was the computer.
Right. But you have to be fair to the humans. That had to be a colloquial conversation, right? So you would have instantaneously would detect that some of these guys had a sense of humor, some were, you know, pitiful, and others were just flat. The flat guy without a sense of humor would be Watson.
Yeah, you know? Although he had an unintentional sense of humor sometimes.
Yeah, exactly, yes.
Is the barrier to creating machine intelligence of some kind that could surpass us set by the fact that we just can't conceive of something that is more complicated than ourselves? Do you think there's a fundamental limit there?
That's an interesting question. I don't think I can answer it.
It's very philosophical. And
yeah, exactly. It's a very interesting question. I think the barriers are more mundane. The barriers, as I said, we have a brain that evolved through a series of quasi-random processes. You know, you probably remember Stephen Jay Gould, Tape of Life experiment. That it was one of my favorites, where he used to say that if you got the tape, suppose you had a tape that has recorded the entire evolution of our species, right? And at the end, just say today, we rewind that tape and we try to play it again to see what would happen at the end of the tape. And he claims, and he was absolutely right when he said that, certainly we would not be here to watch that tape. Because when you rewind and play it again, very likely our species would not even show up, okay? Because the sequence of events that were necessary for us to appear and to evolve in that particular matter may never repeat themselves ever again in the universe. Mm-hmm. So because you cannot reduce, they are statistical, a series of statistical events, and some would claim they're almost random. So since you cannot reproduce that in a computer algorithm, you simply cannot reproduce the process that generate the brain. And you can apply the same reasoning for each one of our individual existences. You know, our brain, in addition to our evolutionary history, is shaped by our personal history. And each of us has a personal history that will never, ever repeat itself in the universe, in the history of the universe. The chances of someone having an identical personal life with everything occurs at the same time, at the same moment, under the same environmental conditions is close to nothing, close to zero. And that creates the impossibility of reproducing the conditions to create a brain like yours or mine or someone else.
How does that apply to the chance of intelligence occurring elsewhere in the universe? Does that change the Drake equation any?
No, I don't think so. I'm referring to human intelligence, but you can have other types of intelligence, of course. And you can have other life forms, certainly there are some. I have no doubt that out there, you know, there should be other types of life forms and other types of intelligence. I'm just describing this little process that refers to our own species.
So,
yeah, I think it's interesting. There was a paper in the archive.org, the physics website, where a bunch of papers are published. Some physicists were looking at the Drake equation again and basically came up with this same idea that based on probabilities that what has happened here on Earth to allow human intelligence to evolve is not necessarily something that could happen anywhere else in the universe. So
right.
there are others who are saying the exact same thing.
Yeah, no, I think when I start researching this material for my book, I thought that, you know, this would be a very small minority, and it's not true. You know, there are a lot of physicists and a lot of philosophers and a lot of people that share the same position. But to some degree, that has not been put out so forcefully as the opposite camp. And so I actually think that is a very interesting debate that we are going to have, and particularly now that we can interface brains and machines, and we're going to start seeing this. You know, I had a very interesting experience a month ago. I was walking into a subway in São Paulo, Brazil, where I'm from, and for the first time in the subway, I saw someone with a cochlear implant. Mm-hmm. I had seen it in the United States. Mm-hmm. I had seen it in Japan, but I had never seen it in Brazil. And I was, you know, just watching to see how people would react because, you know, this guy, of course, had, you know, things on the head protruding, and he was talking on the phone, and clearly he could understand what, you know, the other person in the phone was talking to him, and what is marvelous, is wonderful. But I was trying to see how people, because that was very rare. For me, certainly, was the first time I saw someone in Brazil with a cochlear implant. And people were reacting as if that was okay, natural, you know. So we are going to see that more and more. We are going to see people in the future that are blind walking around in the street, not with a cane anymore, but with these glasses that send signals either to the retina or to the visual cortex, and they'll be walking and crossing streets. We will be able to see that perhaps they're blind, but or they were blind, but now they're using this technology to, you know, live a normal life. And you're going to see people wearing exoskeletons and walking on the sidewalk. So this is going to become more and more common. And it's going to be interesting to see how people react to it.
I'm wondering if the exoskeletons, you talked earlier about the data issue that's going to be coming from that when you're working with 10 to 20,000 neurons that you're processing information from at the same time. I mean, are we going to have super fast wireless communication to the cloud? Is that the only way to be able to get the supercomputing power?
Right. That's very good. I mean, that's one of the things that we are working with. We're also working with a portable unit. So you do most of the number crunching in the beginning of the operation, let's say in the beginning of the day, where you run your models and you get what you need to compute to be sure that you can translate in real time the electrical activity into motor commands. And then once that is done, 5 minutes of that operation that can be done in the cloud, as you said, a supercomputing cloud, you basically download the weights to this unit, you know, the computing weights that you just obtained for that day, and you basically let the unit run for the next 24 hours based on that what you got, and you can adapt it, you know, in a limited sense using a portable hardware that cannot be too heavy. It's almost like having a cell phone in the exoskeleton that is going to operate as a computer unit, autonomous computer unit, but you could do most of the heavy-duty computations using, you know, some sort of remote supercomputer or computer, and through this wireless interface that is already starting to appear. As I said, we are testing here at Duke a device with that, you know, has per board about 128 channels, wireless channels. You can stack these boards together to get close to 1,000 channels. So we are going to be testing this with primates in the next few months.
So Google really becomes our brain.
Yeah, or our interface with Google looks different, you know?
Yeah. I was curious when you were talking about the transmission that is needed for this, especially with the invasive surgery, when you go into the brain. What is your position on the risk of this kind of radiation causing cancer? There's really nothing showing a link yet. There's been a few studies here and there,
yes,
but there's still a lot of work to be done there. Do you worry about that becoming a big obstacle?
Yeah, not for our case, because what we are going to be doing is very different. I don't have a clear understanding myself. You know, I read some of these studies, and it sounds that there is no conclusion yet for, you know, you mean cell phones, right, and other devices that we use normally. In our case, we are going to be broadcasting these signals at a lower power. So I don't think we have to worry too much. Our main worry here is the volume, the sheer volume of data that we have to broadcast, and to be sure that we get that under the constraints of, you know, 300 to 400 milliseconds, Because we, in every experiment that we have done in the last 10 years, one thing is for sure, these interfaces have to operate under the same reaction time that primates and humans operate for them to be useful. If you have a delay, a long delay above a second, basically the animals lose interest in operating the device, and mm-hmm. you don't get anything to work. So everything that we do, including that experiment in which we sent signals to Japan, had to be done under these constraints. And it's a pretty tough one when you start, you know, climbing to 20, 30,000 neurons. But, it, you know, that's what keeps us busy.
Yeah,
and it's pretty much a challenge that I think state-of-the-art engineering can solve now.
Do you look to things like video gaming, where their motivation is different, but they're after the same thing, as low a latency as possible across large distances?
Right. Yeah. No. I don't play video games. My kids do, and they claim that they do like a brain implant to beat their friends, but I haven't allowed that yet to happen. But. Curiously, one thing that is interesting, I have seen my kids play video games for many years. When I start working with video games with our primates, they look alike.
Uh-huh.
The monkeys really want to win, and they want to do things faster, and they have this edge when they become good at it, that they don't want to lose that, you know, edge. So that's how we get things done. It's very interesting. And one time we had some testing, behavior testing with some kids from a high school from my son, and the monkeys were doing better. They're more motivated. The orange reward was better than the little coins that we get to the kids. So, but it was interesting to see that behaviors are very similar.
Yeah. Now, getting back to the practicalities of the brain-computer interface and sort of the more mundane aspects of everyday life, like you were talking about, us not having to reach out and touch the computer anymore. Forget touchscreen. We'll just think our way across. How far off is that ability to control things at the level we want to control? So not just up, down, right, left, but to say, you know, to think the letter K and have it show up, to think a word, maybe the word keep, and have the entire word show up.
Oh, no. Well, we are still far from that yet. We can get movements, you know, a leg and arm movements. People are now starting to do hand control. As I said, we can get tactile feedback now being sent back to the brain of these animals. But we are, you know, as I said, it's only 10 years since, you know, we published this first paper in 1999. John Chapin, my postdoctoral advisor, and I published this paper in 1999 with rats using their brain activity to control a one-dimensional lever to get water, to bring water to their mouth. Well, 10 years later, we are talking reasonably about controlling a whole body, movements of a whole body exoskeleton, what is not too bad in a decade. But we are not at the science fiction level yet. You know, we cannot get Brad Pitt to fire a gun just by thinking, you know, or Angelina Jolie to dunk from that bullet, you know. But, you know, things are moving pretty quickly. If you had asked me in 1999 that we would be talking today about having a quadriplegic patient in 2014 walk again on the opening of the World Cup in Brazil, wearing an exoskeleton, full body exoskeleton controlled by the brain, I would say that you lost your marbles, you know?
Yeah.
But that's exactly what I'm working on. And it seems at the edge of feasibility, you know? And I think a lot of stuff is going to happen in the next decade, because now this is a field of research that, you know, has a lot of people engaged all over the world.
Do you? Go ahead, Kiki.
I was just going to say that I hope that it'll go faster than voice recognition and the technology that we're using for Dragon naturally speaking and the other technologies that we're using to be able to recognize words and what people say. I mean, we've been looking at the possibilities there for well over a decade, and it's mm-hmm. working better, but it's still not there.
No, I agree. I hope we do better than voice recognition too.
Yeah.
Given the let's say we figured out how to improve the resolution of the exterior reading so that you wouldn't have to do implants. If you overcame that obstacle, what could we control today in a typical computing situation?
Yeah, it's difficult because when I talk about the non-invasive techniques, I can only tell you what we know from the signals that we get now, right? Now, certainly you can do some binary choice. There are very good systems, particularly in Europe and in Germany. A good friend of mine, Neil Birbaumer, was the first to develop a communication system in which locking patients that, like Stephen Hawking, that have lost the movements of pretty much the whole body, can use the electrical activity recorded on the surface of the scalp to select letters on a computer screen to basically type a message with their brain activity. This is the only way they can communicate, and this system has been used by several patients. The problem is it's very slow, very tedious, and it takes hours for the patient to write a paragraph.
Because you have to pick each letter.
You don't imagine the letters of the words. You really use the signal to control a cursor to select letters from a menu. You know, pretty much like systems that use eye movements. Some systems are used to do the same thing. That is the state of the art right now. And it's very useful for that population of patients because they really do not have other ways to communicate. But you would not use that. None of us would, because it's too slow and too cumbersome to operate. So if you could get the kind of signals that we get invasively on using a non-invasive technique, you have the state-of-the-art on these experiments that we have published over the last few years. You can reach for objects, you can grab objects, bring objects close to you. You can probably control robotic legs to walk, you know, if you're wearing a lower body exoskeleton, although balance is a serious issue that has not been solved yet. Just to keep upright would be a difficult task.
Is that because of the feedback? You need more feedback?
Yes. Oh, yes, yes. You need more tactile and proprioceptive feedback. Only visual feedback will not do it for you. And you really need to control a variety of muscle groups, axial musculature to keep you up while you're walking and changing your, you know, distribution of weight. And so it's a complicated issue. This is in the realm of feasibility in the next 5 years or so, okay? If you could record the signals we get inside the brain from outside, that would make our lives a lot easier to implement this first generation of neuroprosthetic devices. Because, of course, you would remove a serious obstacle that is to have to go into the brain. But you wouldn't move too far into what you were thinking, you know, in terms of playing violin, for instance, or typing on a keyboard. Which would be very difficult today to do with the current state of the art of these interfaces.
Point and click is about all you got, sounds like.
Well, no, it's more than that. You can reach, you can point, you can grab, you can drag.
Can I click? Can you control an artificial hand to do typing?
Well, it hasn't been done yet. It hasn't been tested experimentally, but I know of people that secretly in their labs are dreaming of doing it.
Yeah.
Yes. This is something, of course, that would be an amazing demonstration. And I think it can be done in the next few years. But again, that is all related to the number of neurons that you can record.
Right.
So as you get to this more complicated and well-coordinated, I'll give an example. We just move in our lab to a paradigm in which we are trying to use brain activity to control both hands simultaneously and do bimanual behaviors, monkeys. We were able to train the monkeys, one monkey to do this task, what is a difficult task for monkeys to learn. And now we are going to know in the next 4 months whether the brain activity recorded simultaneously from both hemispheres, cortical hemispheres, can allow this animal to use both hands to manipulate objects or to, you know, drag objects bimanually. So that would be a good quantitative measurement of how far we are from being able to actually control two hands to, let's say, do typing or other more complicated behaviors.
Well, I only use two fingers to type anyway, so maybe I can be a template.
Oh, yeah, that will reduce the problem, yes. That'll make it certainly much easier. Yeah,
the hunt and peck typers.
Well, Kiki, I think we're about at the end. Do you have any questions before we wrap up?
No, I think this has just been absolutely fascinating, and your research, Dr. Nicolaides, is stuff that I've been following since for the last 10 years about, and so it's really wonderful to get the chance to speak with you. I guess finally, my final question is for your research and what we're doing. We'll go to the dark side a little bit. There's some research that. With electrodes that we do we can remotely control rats, and this has to do with sending inputs into the brain. Is there any possibility of your research being used to remotely control humans?
Gee, no, I'm not an expert on the dark side because I was born in Brazil, and we are from the tropics, and there's a lot of light there.
Okay.
So we never think about the dark side. Oh yeah, when I was in medical school. I remember vividly that a surgeon that was one of my professors came in the emergency room in São Paulo, which is one of the busiest in the planet. You see 1,000 patients a night. It's like a mesh unit, okay? And he came with one of these big pens, the classic fountain pen, and took the cap and said, I'm going to teach you how to do a tracheostomy with the cap of the pen. And he didn't do it in a human, but it can be done. So what I tell my students is that any piece of technology can be used for bad stuff, right? And the role of society is to make it sure that it is not done, it's not used for bad stuff, that is regulated, controlled, and it serves, in our case, a humanitarian purpose. So I have talked to science fiction writers and all sorts of people that have the worst possible scenarios you can tell me, and I don't even can't mention them, some of them, and sure, someone could try to do it, but certainly not us, and certainly is not the purpose that we work, for this type of stuff. There is always a risk. Computers can be used, music can be used for a bad purpose, but I haven't seen it. Curiously, people mention this, and I'm in all these meetings, I go to all these meetings, and I never seen it. And maybe there is someone secretly developing something, but I have never seen in the scientific community any idea or any study that would suggest what you mentioned.
Right.
Although in theory, of course, you can always think about it.
Right.
You can. And if they're working on it in secret, it might be like the Raelians who've been secretly working on cloning
humans. Romulans. Or the Romulans. Yeah. Or the Klingons, yes.
Exactly. Klingons.
They're about the same, aren't they? All right, Miguel, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to
pleasure.
Us. It's really fascinating, and you're doing great stuff. Let folks know where they can keep up with your work and how they can find out more about it.
Well, one thing is I just recently published a book called Beyond Boundaries where I describe the last 10 years of this research and the history of neuroscience related to this research. And also in our website, we have a site for Beyond Boundaries Net where you can see not only some of the data, the movies, but also the music that inspired some of this research. That's an interesting take. And also in our website, nicolaileslab.net.
All right. Well, thank you again, Miguel.
Thank you very much for the invitation. It was a great pleasure talking to both of you.
It was fabulous. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Oh, that was really fun. I really enjoyed talking to him, and just really opens up your mind to all kinds of there were things I was thinking about during this that I'd never thought about before.
Which is, what we hope that this program does for people and the conversations that you have here with people like Miguel, it opens your mind, gets you thinking about the future, gets you thinking about the present, and even thinking about the way humans have been throughout the past. So, I'm going to take a lot with me from today, a lot more than just reading the little tiny news blurbs that we get throughout the week. You know, this was a great conversation.
Good stuff. And it got me thinking of all kinds of crazy science fiction ideas, especially when he's talking there at the end about all of the sci-fi people he talks to. It almost feels weird to talk about Netflix in this situation, but they've got great sci-fi television shows and movies on there where you can see some of these thought experiments play out on your television, on your iPad, on your iPhone, all of that stuff. Try out Netflix for free, netflix.com/twit. You get 30 days for free. Pass it along to your friends. We thank them for their support, without which we couldn't have these great talks with people like Miguel. That's it for this episode of Triangulation. Dr. Kiki, thanks so much for filling in. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. I had so much fun.
All right. We'll see you next time, folks.